You know what they say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Like a TMF index. On this episode of The State of TMF, host Oliver will be joined by special guest Ann Ackley-Pfeiffer from Daylight Solutions for a deep dive into the CDISC TMF reference model. They'll be discussing how organizations, large and small, can leverage this universally recognized standard and adapt it to serve their master TMF indexes. Plus, they'll cover how industry standards like the CDISC TMF reference model can help bring the clinical research community together and bring drugs to market faster. The State of TMF podcast is officially in session. Let's get into it.
I'll introduce Ann. So Ann, thanks so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I am doing fantastic. Thank you. Would love just to sort of maybe start with some brief introductions on your end. Maybe you could just introduce yourself, your role at your current organization, and maybe give us a little bit of a background into your career so far.
Oh, goodness. Well, I'll tell you, my career didn't start in clinical research, you know, by choice. I was an 18-year-old kid who loved anime. So I went to college for Japanese studies. Go figure, right? I was looking for work closer to home at the time in 2006. And my brother-in-law at the time was working at ICON, and there was an opening at the ground level for a document management assistant. So I really did start just completely fresh, not knowing anything. And I quickly realized that it played on a lot of my strengths. And, you know, I've been through the CRO side of things, the sponsor side of things, and now I'm on the consulting side of things with Daylight Solutions. And well, my 3-year anniversary was Friday. So been with them for 3 years as a senior consultant. And it's been TMF all the way up from the ground level up. So I know all the problems from a broad scope.
All of the, yeah, I'm coming from the paper world into the electronic, no doubt.
Oh, yeah. Big time. That was really the big transformation period. You know, you started seeing some documentum systems at that time. But like some of the more modern database type systems was really around that 2011, 2012 mark, when it was less tag-em a bag-em kind of systems, as I like to call them, and more of an active repository.
Right. When I like to say when TMF moved out of the basement, right?
Like, yeah.
That kind of time frame. And I was going to ask you what drew you into clinical research. I mean, what that sort of initial job, it was really just sort of something that was referred and you thought, why not? And then you fell in love with it from that point, or was sort of the love longer over time? It sort of grew over time.
Well, I have this uncanny knack for putting things where they belong and a high attention to detail. So, I mean, God, remember back in the day, 2006, the scan room parties, we'd have music going, and it was just dopamine hit after dopamine hit, getting those documents in and making sure they were done correctly. And it became almost like a game for me. So it kind of grew on me organically, really. Kind of strange. But
amazing. Okay, perfect. And what are some of the things that you do on a day-to-day today as a senior consultant at Daylight? What are some of the projects that you work on?
Oh, goodness. I mean, it can be anything from, you know, acting as a TMF lead resource. It could be evaluating processes and system configurations to maximize the benefit to the customer. I've also been expanding my world into migrations. So I'm learning a lot there. So really a jack of all trades, I guess you could say, where I'm needed, I fit in.
And working a lot, I'm assuming, around sort of like the reference model and index development and things like that, right? Which is the main subject of today's discussion. Now, I sort of want to preface this with maybe a little bit of context, because I think, especially in my experience within the TMF world, the index is sort of like one of those things that you hear just so many varied stories of. Some organizations are, you know, taking the reference model as gospel and sort of rolling it out and mapping and doing a lot of those types of exercises. Or some of them are sort of taking it and say, this really doesn't apply to me, and I'm going to heavily customize what I'm doing. And then there's folks, obviously, that are somewhat in between. Maybe they're sort of taking more of a hybrid approach. This discussion that we're having today sort of really spurred from an article that you'd written a few weeks ago around the TMF index and how to create an adaptable TMF index for any study, leveraging the reference model more directly. Some of the points in the article that I thought were really interesting is you referenced some of the drawbacks of heavily customizing TMF indexes. So maybe we can start by talking a little bit about, you know, why do you think organizations might initially choose to deviate so much from the standard TMF reference model? And why are some of those things challenging? Why do they present potential challenges with that sort of heavy customization?
Well, you can group them into three main reasons, at least in my experience. The first is that the sponsor is using a CRO who has their own system and their own index, known way of doing things. And so, you know, the sponsor will rely on the CRO to take care of their documents for them. They don't have any say in how things are done. So that's one reason. The next reason is we still have some process relics from paper days. Really, the mindset needs to shift forward. And so I can dig deeper into each of these reasons later, of course. And then the third reason is they're really trying to gain control of that completeness picture with extreme granularity. Just briefly, I've seen indexes with upwards of 1,000+ artifacts. So I can dig more into that later.
Amazing. So one of the first sort of reasons why you mentioned people deviate is when there's those sort of like CRO specific indexes, or you know, you're working with a partner. How significant is that an issue in your experience? And you know, you mentioned earlier things like migration, you know, perhaps changing of CRO. What are some of the things that you see that are kind of really challenging in that area when we're adopting something as different perhaps as a CRO specific index that maybe isn't as well aligned to the way we work today?
I'd say it's significant enough that, you know, the complications that arise from not being able to easily map one to one really makes a project more expensive for the client. And, you know, it's not just a matter of changing systems, you know, there's a lot of acquisitions and mergers going on. And if we could guarantee that each organization would have the same framework, even if they use it in a slightly different manner, it would really cut down on the cost of, you know, for instance, when you're mapping multiple to one, there are programmatic ways of teasing that data out and splitting it up, but not always. There's some manual review that needs to be done on the ones that can't be handled programmatically. And manual time is a lot of cost. So I would say one good piece of advice to follow when you're with a CRO, when you're shopping for CRO partners, is ask them if their index aligns with the latest CDISC TMF reference model. Save you some headaches in the end.
And when you say align here, you know, if I'm a you know, on a sponsor team and I'm shopping for that CRO, like you said, when I'm asking that question, am I looking to dive into how much they are deviating from that reference model? Because I would imagine a lot of CROs are probably at least using the baseline of the reference model. How far do I go as a member of the sponsor team in trying to dig into how much they're heavily customizing the reference model? And does that add to the complexity later on?
I mean, any customization will add to the complexity because, you know, with a data standard, which is the attempt of the reference model to set a standard, everybody's speaking the same language, and it's not just people, but systems. And so, you know, even small customizations can cause hiccups. I mean, some of them are easy to map, but it really depends on the depth of the customization that the organization does to the reference model itself.
And what about for, let's say, you know, some of those edge use cases? Sometimes we might find organizations that are, let's say, conducting medical device studies. And so maybe there are slight nuances there. How do you typically recommend you reviewing that when we're shopping for CROs as well? Is that a key consideration?
Well, when you consider that the reference model team at CDISC is, you know, considering the involvement of studies to include, you know, different types, new technologies, all kinds of things like that. I would say that's a tough one.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the obviously, you know, when we think about the TMF reference model, we have to think about the use cases that it's currently being designed for. And, you know, in some cases there may need to be some customization, but in the sort of traditional sense, perhaps we try and sort of remain as aligned as possible with it. The second reason that you mentioned in the article that you wrote around sort of deviation was around the process relics, right? From those paper days, the basement era. Could you give some sort of more examples of how some of those outdated practices persist in today and what impact that has on the index itself?
Sure. Well, one example I can give is, a piece of information that's, needed on hand is, the initial regulatory authority approvals, a list of them for all countries. Now, with modern CTMSs, that's a quick report away. But some are uncomfortable with reporting. Maybe reporting isn't set up in somebody's system in an intuitive manner. Some people do this manual tracking, and then they need to file this document away because back when it was done externally exclusively, they would have needed to put that document in the TMF. There may be an SOP thing that still needs to go in the TMF. But, moving to modernization, the report should be sufficient for a look in. But you could kind of do a hybrid model if you think about it. Running a report gives you a picture of what it was at a certain time point. So if you wanted to give yourself a historical view, you could download the report at a certain frequency, and then you could file it in the already existing under the regulatory zone, the general classification of tracking information. And then you'll have stacked up all the reports from the different time points, and then you can collate them and analyze the data. And it really, doing it both ways can give you additional information.
Amazing. There's a question that came in from Sylvia here just to, that I think we can quickly answer and move on. The difference between the DIA reference model and the CDISC reference model, they're ultimately the same. The reference model was started when it was associated or initiated by the DIA as a working group, and has since transitioned to the CDISC organization. So it's now part of CDISC. Question here from Jeff around how best to adapt and use the reference model for non-interventional studies. Are there nuances in that area that you've seen, or is that something that you haven't worked on yet?
I actually have not worked with a non-interventional study myself, but if you think of the artifacts on the reference model as more process boxes instead of thinking specifically about document titles, because that can really box you in into a company-specific mindset instead of an overarching mindset. So really, even with non-interventional studies, you're still going to have all the main components, and any other components that come in could very easily fit into those boxes. And again, I'm pretty sure that the large panel of industry experts at CDISC have already considered this in their design, constantly revising and reviewing this for evolvement of studies.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a useful use case for any of those other edge cases or other different types of studies, is that really what we've got to think about, and sometimes you're right, we get caught up in this document type or artifact type naming, and we think, well, this document doesn't look like that, or it doesn't sound like that, and so where do I put it? And so sometimes we then create a new document type or artifact type for that, and then we get into this rat race of customizing and creating it for everything. And naturally, there are always going to be nuances in the way that one company names a specific type of document versus another. Even regionally, perhaps there are folks and colleagues that are maybe in a different region in Europe versus the US are calling things differently. But ultimately, I think what you're proposing here, Anne, is that these process boxes that you would typically sort of think of as an artifact placeholder are really sort of the guardrails in which you should place these documents versus like trying to match the name like for like, absolutely. Is that sort of the general gist?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, everything that you need to show that a process is being followed. So example, informed consent form, you only need one artifact. You don't need to split it out into all the different types and the checklists and approvals. You could stick everything related to the ICF development and the ICF itself in that artifact, and then make use of your metadata, particularly if your system supports free text fields. You know, it's so easy to just want to throw the document in and just want to be done with it. But, you know, when it comes to finding the needle in a haystack later, you know, enrich your metadata in your free text field, maybe with the document title or an abbreviation for the document title, something that'll point to it so that when you see a million things filed as ICF between the date and the free text field, you can get a quick, oh, yeah, that's that one.
So. Exactly. And this is something that, we see often with our customers, right? So, you know, in our system, it's that same thing. We have that reference model ID, the artifact ID that we're using, that perhaps is that process box that you reference. And then you have that free text field where you add granularity, where you add context to what that document is. And that helps you then map some of those fringe documents, like you mentioned, into a placeholder that makes sense. What I'm interested in understanding is, what's the true benefit of doing that? What's the true benefit of trying as often as possible to map to an existing process box or artifact type that you referenced? And what do you think are the true benefits there?
Oh, well, the benefit is that acquisitions and mergers are going to be much, much easier. Training. When you consider organizations that have 1,000+ artifact indexes, you know, staff turnover is going to happen. So you'll always have that one or two reliable people in your department who've been there forever and know everything. But as people cycle through, think of the practicality of some, especially somebody new to clinical research, of knowing those 1,000 artifact types and being able to accurately, you know, you end up with inconsistent filing for longer. You know, if you start training in terms of process boxes and you start to get them to understand the trial, and then they'll make better decisions, you know, when it comes to indexing those documents.
And I think another benefit too is that, look, the reference model is an all evolving thing, right? So every time there's a new version, there's a review of the artifacts and the sub artifacts. I think a few minor versions ago, they introduced over 650 sub artifacts into the reference model to counter the differences and the nuances in documentation that perhaps is being created or collected in studies. And so if you're mapping you know, existing documents that you have to these process boxes or these artifacts that exist in the reference model, when there is an evolution, and correct me if I'm wrong, you'll then be able to even if you're capturing that you know, nuance document name in a free text field, it's very easy then to map that to maybe a new artifact type that's introduced by the reference model, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And one invaluable tool is having a master index for your organization that delves into company-specific terminology and expectations. You know, you can take the reference model and not alter it, but maybe add some columns to it to describe company-specific things. And also, too, with your master index, one of the things that I like to do is I like to turn the document into an intuitive training document. I mean, yeah, you can have training all over the place. And when people are working, they just want to stick with their things that they have. So when they have the index open, they don't want to have to go to training to take a look at things. So have your index lead them on what types of information is found in each of the columns and how to use it. Little hover over a note at the top of each column really is just invaluable. And that's something that I've done a lot with clients.
Amazing. Quick, a couple questions here coming in from the audience. So Mana asks if the CDIS team is working on anything for device and diagnostic arenas, as it's very focused on pharma and interventional today. There are a number of really interesting subgroups and working groups at the reference model. If anybody is not already attending the general meetings that are occurring with the CDISC TMF reference model, head to cdisc.org, I think, to navigate and sign up for updates. It's completely free and you can attend those meetings for free also. That is when the steering committee is talking about their roadmap for initiatives and a number of other things. I do know that there are a number of initiatives around adapting or adopting the model itself to apply to different areas. Another question here. With the reference model, I've seen the industry move toward a more risk-based approach. All documents are important, but how to decipher between major and minor documents in regards to QC? Any thoughts there, Anne? I'm thinking here that what they're referencing is, you know, do we think that the reference model would evolve towards accounting for more of a risk-based QC, or a risk-based approach with the instructions that they give on an artifact level?
Well, there's a lot of chat about risk-based approach for multiple organizations, so I'm pretty sure CDISC is on that. I think that they will be including some more risk-based information. But just think if you're in evaluating it internally, just try to think in terms of, if I didn't have this specific process documented, you know, would an ethics committee or a regulatory agency still allow us to continue? So, you know, without informed consent, you don't have a trial. You know, without your ethics committee approval, you don't have a trial. So start to think in terms of, you know, if I strip this away, will it take a big piece of the story away or a little piece of the story away, and, you know, prioritize that way?
Absolutely. Couple of things there on a risk-based approach. As Anne mentioned, there are a number of companies talking about a risk-based approach. For those of you that, again, are subscribed to what we do here over at Montreal, you'll know that we recently released a almost 30-page document on risk-based TMF and how to implement. So head to the Montreal website and you'll be able to download that. And then Dawn appropriately mentioned in the chat that there is also an ongoing risk initiative within the reference model that Dawn is a part of, as well as Donatella from the Montreal team and a number of other folks in the industry. So certainly, again, continue to attend those general meetings that are occurring with the TMF reference model. They aren't just fluff. There's a lot of really great conversation that's happening there. And obviously, it's your opportunity to ask and understand where things are coming in the future. All right. We've answered a whole bunch of questions here, so I'm going to try and get back to sort of our plan for the conversation. The third reason that you mentioned around why people deviate from the reference model, and I love the term you used. It's really because people are attempting to control completeness with extreme granularity. Could you sort of walk us through your perspective there, and yeah, you know, what's the way we should be thinking about this?
And again, I point back to process boxes, because if you're thinking in terms of document titles, you're going to end up, you know, adding new titles every time you're revising your index. I mean, and it's just, you're going to keep chasing and never get anywhere. So I would say one of the challenges with completeness metrics is getting that metric is only as good as what either your external trackers or your in-system trackers is fed. To give an example, let's say there's been three major submissions for every site in one country to an IRB up to this point. But maybe for one or two of those sites, there was a little back and forth, maybe some clarifications, you know, maybe a resubmission needed to happen. So somebody who is setting up that an essential documents list type thing, you know, would say, okay, well, there's three, so I'm going to put three down for all the US sites. Not giving the picture. There's no context to those numbers. How do you know, you know, without being the person responsible for that site, that perhaps we should be expecting four or five because of the resubmissions and things. So there's no context given to those numbers. So they're often blindly followed. And I really have to say that there is no substitute for both people on the study team and an experienced TMF lead to work together for a manual review, because context teases itself out of documents themselves, opening and reading them and seeing what's going on. I know upper management loves their fancy reports and things and wants everything at the touch of a button, but what they're getting is not what they're asking for, I find, in a lot of situations.
Now, I think a lot of folks have, you know, there are probably other reasons or the individual organizations or teams deviate from that core reference model. I think what we've talked about thus far and what we've ultimately done is build a really good business case for how to align as much as possible and use these process buckets, as you mentioned, sort of translating the artifact type and placing those documents in there. The idea behind it, I think, is great. What I want to try and dig into now is if I'm an organization that is sort of, I've now bought into that use case, I want to start using the reference model more completely. What are some of the initial steps that you'd recommend an organization take if they want to start, you know, aligning a little bit more closely to the reference model and taking that adaptive TMF index approach that you've referenced?
Start with the reference model, get together people from each functional line. You'll want buy-in from across the board, and you'll want to look at the documentation that your company produces and all the titles involved with that. Of course, as studies evolve, there'll be other things, but just take with what you know now and, you know, just start mapping them. What process box does this document satisfy? And you'll find it'll start falling together. They're really, I mean, if you read the definitions beside the artifact, it'll give you a further clue as to exactly what they're looking for in each of those boxes. So it really is just a full across the board functional line heads meeting to develop that master index and to be able to build the columns in, you know, the company specific things like who's responsible for generating what document, those sorts of things that we build into a master index.
And then the idea then is to sort of say, okay, well, what are, you know, historically, what are all the different types of documents that we've collected, created, that ultimately come up over the course of a study? And then understanding, going through sort of a pre-study, ideally mapping exercise. So you build that master TMF index to say, okay, well, we've got all these three artifacts here. Well, these likely map to this one process box or this one TMF reference model artifact. And then that provides sort of the guardrails, I would say, for the study teams to be able to use. Is that sort of the recommendation there, Anne?
Absolutely. Yeah, sticking within the framework, the guardrails will keep you from branching and adding too many things.
And that really, I think, emphasizes the flexibility. I think probably a lot of people look at the reference model and think, oh, this rigid, structured thing that I, you know, maybe doesn't always fit with what I'm doing or what my study looks like. But in reality, most of the time, and this is something that I've explored at length with our customers, is that 99% of the time, unless you're doing something very, very different from everybody else, you can map an existing document type that you have to an artifact type in the reference model. And so if we align as much as possible, all of those benefits that we've discussed today just make it that much easier on your team. Would love to dig into sort of any success stories or case studies that you've seen as you've helped other organizations sort of maybe adapt or implement that TMF master index that you referenced. Anything that you can share there?
Well, sure. Some recent work for a client, they didn't seem to be on board with the idea of the reference model at first. But I did a mapping exercise for them and showed them just exactly how easy it was. And, you know, getting it out to them very quickly, you know, helped raise that confidence and like, oh yeah, this is easy. And you know what? That makes sense. Because it's a company that, you know, takes in, stuff from other organizations. So, you know, again, that whole system to system transfer of things, you know, getting things externally to internally would be facilitated by moving to the standard.
Amazing. Last real question for you on sort of the index side of things. What's your, you know, you've been involved in the industry for I think you said 18 or so years at this point. Obviously, you're an active member in the TMF reference model community. How do you see the future of TMF management evolving, especially when it comes to sort of data standards like the reference model? What does the future look like in your opinion?
Ah, this is going to be the hippie in me talking. I see data standards as a way of bringing organizations together, particularly when we think of new technologies like machine learning and AI. The larger players have an enormous data set to work with to be able to train their systems. Smaller companies, not so much. But what we may see is between speaking the same language and the need for a large data set is maybe consortiums of of small companies working together to bring a compound to market, owning a share in it. You know, so it's not just one company, it's their thing. You got people from all over working together. You won't have the constraints of a small company not having the manpower because you have more people working together. And I think it'll bring the drugs faster to market. And, you know, it'll help those little guys really come in and compete with the larger organizations that have the hoard of data.
And I think obviously there's a lot happening on the standard side right now, not only with what's happening at CDS, but also other organizations like ICH. And so we're seeing things like M11. We're seeing things like digital data flow. And obviously, you know, the role that the CDISC community is playing in that. So there's obviously a lot happening here and a lot of standardization promise that I think is not too far down the road. Last question for you before we wrap up today. I ask this to everyone that comes on. What do you think your TMF superpower is?
If you know, This is going to sound strange, but my success in TMF is contributed by both my greatest weakness and my greatest strength. I'm an autistic person, which explains my attention to detail and a knack for analyzing data patterns and working within frameworks. It really has helped me as a person who is internally very disorganized to learn external organization skills. So not only did I find a good career in TMF, but being able to learn to work within frameworks and externally organize myself, it's helped me in my own personal life as well.
So, oh, that's amazing.
That's it.
And you're getting a ton of love from the audience here. I'm seeing hearts and claps and all kinds of stuff. So I agree. I think, you know, there's certainly a huge benefit to that. And I love that that's your superpower. We've had a ton of questions today, so thank you, Anne, so much for sort of taking us through it. Melissa says this is our tribe. This is absolutely our tribe. So many people joined us today. It's been so great to talk about the TMF index. Obviously, this was just the tip of the iceberg in terms of a discussion on the subject. If you're interested in learning more about Anne's perspective, head over to Daylight Solutions. There's obviously a ton of great content that Anne has written on this subject. And of course, you can always head to the ModStream website where we've talked ad nauseum about the reference model and the TMF index. So lots of really, really great resources there. And thank you so much for spending some time with me today to talk about the index and the reference model. It's been great. We'll have to have you back on at some point in the future.
Sounds great. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, everyone. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of The State of TMF. If you liked today's episode, hit the subscribe button, view the full episode with video on YouTube, and follow us on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook to see the sometimes entertaining and always resourceful content we post every single day. See you in April for episode 7.